Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Saturday, January 17th, 2015. This is episode 1153. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter makes hiring faster, easier, and cheaper. Post your job to 50-plus job boards with one click. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/Tech Guy. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Tech Guy. And by RingCentral, the business phone system that's in the cloud. Stop using that clunky, hard-to-use, and expensive PBX. That's what we did. Try RingCentral now with a 30-day risk-free trial. Visit RingCentral.com or call 800-543-9980 and use the promo code TWIT. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk about computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, home theater, digital photography, anything with a chip in it. That's what we talk about on the show. Hope you enjoy it. Hope you enjoy the show. 8888 Ask Leo is the number if you want to dive in, make a comment, or suggestiones. 8888 Ask Leo. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Outside the U.S. or Canada, well, golly, I guess you could use Skype. We do get calls from all over the world, and I love that. Skype will do it for you because it's toll free. So let's see. What is the? You know, I like at the beginning of each show to talk a little bit about the latest news in the technology world, the thing people are talking about. There's, as usual, a number of stories. Drones are in the news again. Turns out it's the lobbying with the Federal Aviation Administration to block drones, particularly commercial drone use, is coming from pilots. Now, that kind of makes sense, because if I were a pilot, I wouldn't want to have to crash into a flock of drones. That would be dangerous. But then others are pointing out, yeah, these are the same pilots, the crop dusters, the guys who and gals who fly helicopters for movie crews. These are the people who are being put out of business, who are losing work to drones. Well, it's always more complicated than it seems. Pilot pressure is causing the FAA's indecisiveness on drones, according to GigaOM, which is a very popular and well-respected, I might add, tech blog. Drone policy, writes Jeff John Roberts, is a mess in the U.S. The Federal Aviation Administration is currently grounding commercial use of unmanned aircraft. Did you know that? A lot of realtors and farmers still use drones. Turns out, I was talking to somebody who just bought a drone. He said, I want to use it as a for my real estate business. I want to make a video of the property we're selling. And the guy who sold it to him said, yeah. He said, I heard that it's illegal. Yeah. Here's the problem. The FAA has no enforcement arm. So they can say it, but who's going to do it? So people are still flying drones. It's actually, the commercial use worries me less than just the number of people, thousands and thousands of people who are just flying around. Here's a video of a guy, according to CNN, who crashed. First of all, you're not supposed to have drones in the national park. They're supposed to be calm, serene, not... He crashed his drone into the hot springs at Yellowstone National Park. And then had the chutzpah to approach the park staff and say, hey, can you get my drone? It's in the hot springs. The Park Service said we allowed the person who flew the drone to leave. We didn't arrest him. Unclear whether the drone caused any damage to the hot spring. That's not good. There was a drone that crashed in the Grand Canyon. Tourists have been using drones to harass bighorn sheep in Utah. It does. I mean, I have to say, there's some beautiful imagery coming out of these. You know, it's misnamed to call them drones, first of all. A drone, I guess they're a drone of kind. They're an unmanned flying vehicle, but they're quadcopters for the most part. These are four-bladed helicopters. Usually they can carry, mostly they carry cameras. The four blades give them more lift, so they can lift a heavy payload like a camera, but also give them stability, so they hover. And they really do give you a beautiful shot if you've ever played with these. But we're all waiting to find out what the Federal Aviation Administration wants to do. The Wall Street Journal says, quote, aerial surveyors, photographers, and movie-making pilots are increasingly losing business to robots. Welcome to the 21st century. There are no talk show host robots yet. Well, actually, after listening to a few of them, maybe there are. They're losing their jobs to robots that could do their job faster, cheaper, and better. That competition, paired with concerns about mid-air collisions with drones, which are legitimate concerns, have made commercial pilots the fiercest opponents to unmanned aircraft. And yet, what are they banning? Commercial use, which is often piloted by professionals. And there's no ban at all on you going out and getting a drone and flying it into the power lines. No problem. Go right ahead. Not against the law. They're beautiful. I was talking to David Pogue this week, my friend David Pogue, who you probably know of. 11 years writing at the New York Times. He's now at the Yahoo Tech page and does those great videos on CBS Sunday Morning. You've probably seen him. And he explained to me why. I said, why are drones so popular, David? He said, because we're ants on a tablecloth. I said, what? He said, all our lives we have walked around on this flat earth in a two-dimensional space, very rarely getting a view of from any other angle. He said, you get in an airplane, sure, but you're a couple miles high. The drone is a few hundred feet high, and it really shows you what it looks like if you were there like a bird. And he's right. I think that there's a certain when you see these drone videos, or more, even better, yeah, when you go out and you get a drone and you put a camera on it, it's remarkable. My favorite thing to do, I haven't done it, but I see people do it, is the drone selfie. Have you seen this? Where you start the drone like as in front of you as a selfie. You go hi, and then you go woo when you fly away, and you see yourself receding as the globe recedes. It's an incredible shot. I love that. Anyway, we're still waiting for the FAA to make a ruling. It is a great hobby. There are lots of risks. People often fly their drone out of remote control reach. And if you do that and you don't have a drone that's properly designed, it will just fall out of the sky at some point when it runs out of juice and hits somebody possibly. And some of these drones are big enough that if it hits you, it's not going to be good. It could kill you. Now, a well-designed drone, there are a couple of things. Some of these drones have GPSs, will come back and get you. They'll say, oh, I'm out of reach, and they'll fly back to you. Others will just kind of spiral in a circle around where they are in ever-increasing circles until they find you. Again, that's a well-designed drone. The problem is there are lots of cheapo drones. I just bought the SYMA, S-Y-M-A, because I want to get into this little expanding, wonderful world of drones. You can get it on Amazon, a SYMA X5, $40, very inexpensive. Now, this doesn't have a camera, and it cannot carry a camera in all likelihood. But what's good about it is you can practice your dronage. You can, because this is, I think, important. If you're going to do the drone thing, before you put an expensive camera on it, before you risk life and limb of others around you, that you know a little bit about what you're doing. And it's nice because these are fairly inexpensive. So that means you can get one of these and take it outside, preferably an open field where there are no power lines. No people. You could just fly it around to your heart's content. And if it crashes, you're the only person it'll hit. Let's hope it doesn't hit you. But I think this is fun. me see which one I got. And when I think I'm getting it today. I think, forget the show, I'm going home. I think it came. It's, yes, it did. Oh, I'm excited. No, I'm sorry. No, it's not till next week. Okay, I'll stay and do the show. Explorer's quadcopter. Have you tried one of these? You have some opinions on dronage? Let's talk about it. 8888 Ask Leo. I want to talk about David Cameron, too, a little later on. Lots to talk about. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. X5C. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. You know who else is here? I'm not alone. I'm not sitting all alone. I'm practically alone. But I'm almost alone. But I'm not completely alone, because here in the studios with me is the lovely and talented Heather Hammond, the phone ranger. She is, of course, separated from me by double panes of glass. Bulletproof glass. But she is here answering the phones. Hello, Heather.
Hello.
Did you have a lovely week?
Yes.
Good.
Even it was very foggy, but that's okay.
It was foggy, chilly, but we didn't have 8 feet of snow like the rest of the country, so I'm not complaining.
Me neither. I want folks to know that. Yeah. I rode my bike, and I didn't cry, and it's fine.
Look, I my hair is growing back.
Oh, my gosh. I think we're going to need to get in there with do some shaping.
No. I want every inch. I love it. I shaved my hair for charity on New Year's Day, and here it is 2 weeks later, and it's getting there. Getting there.
It sure is.
Who should we start this fine radio program
and if
with?
I didn't know, folks. He used to have a lovely head
I
of
used
hair.
To, I used to. That's what's sad about this.
It's coming back, though.
Is it?
It's not is sad it? At all. What
I
if you were
look
really
like
bald?
It kind of looks like I might not get it all back.
No, it's coming back. It's going to come roaring back.
Better.
You
better.
Should grow it longer even this time.
I am. You know, that's what I thought. In reaction, I'm going to make it crazy long.
Yeah, just to see what Lisa says then, your girlfriend.
Yeah. In my reaction to not having any hair. It's an experience.
Yeah.
So who should I talk to here?
Well, Mark in San Diego has a little bit of a drone/FAA story to share with
excellent.
You.
Excellent. Thank you, Heather. Hello, Mark. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. How you doing?
I am well. How are you?
We're good. Hey, we have an exemption currently pending in front of the FAA.
We being, are you a realtor or?
My company.
Yeah.
So we applied back in July, and I heard your conversation about drones and multirotors, and just wanted to kind of make a few comments.
They have made this last week, they made two exemptions for real estate and agriculture companies. So they are right. They are doing that, I think.
They're moving slowly along.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah.
Do you fly the drone or?
Yeah, sure do.
Oh, cool. How do you like it?
It's awesome. It's, from a little kid, always wanted to fly, but never had the wings. So it's like flying like you're a bird. It's
yeah. Just, I think that's kind of the appeal of it, is that suddenly you're seeing the world from, like, as a bird would. I think that's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I just want to make a few comments, kind of give some pointers to some of your
Please. Audience. That would be great. And as I'm about to get my first drone, I'd love to hear them, too.
Yeah, the first thing you want to do is make sure, first of all your batteries are charged.
Yeah.
And
they don't last that long, do they? I mean, most drones, maybe 10, 15 minutes, 20 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
20 minutes is really on the high end. You're looking probably around 10.
Yeah. Or less.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that goes into planning your flight. So you always want to kind of have an idea of what you want to do.
Uh-huh.
You want to look for obstacles around you.
Good.
Some poles.
Awareness. Don't just launch into the air and then, oh, golly.
Right. And the lighter your multirotor is, the more the wind is going to affect it.
The lighter your
multirotor is, the more the wind affects it.
So,
and the wind speed where you are on the ground is not what it is 40 feet over.
Another good tip. It might be quite windy up there.
Yeah. You never want to fly over property you don't have the permission to fly over.
Okay. And that includes national parks, apparently.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you can't walk there with permission, don't
right.
fly there.
Right. Yeah, I think the real concerns most people have are safety, but also privacy.
Right.
Yeah, because you don't want to look out your window and see a drone hovering there or looking into your bedroom.
And you don't want to be operating it, and you get the cops show up and ask what you're doing.
Will that happen too? Do they pay attention to that?
Well, if they get a phone call, sure they'll show up.
Yeah, yeah. What's
and I guess the last thing you want to do is always fly with somebody else. Sometimes when you're up there, that your perspective on the distance between you and obstacles and your quadcopter or octocopter is not what, you know, you've got one person perspective. Well, if you have second person perspective who is maybe 50 feet away from you, they can help you hear better. They can help you be a safety monitor, which is a really key.
Always use the buddy system. Don't drone alone.
Use the buddy system. Yeah, so we're real excited about it. Hopefully soon our FAA exemption will come through, and we've been using our business is real estate and promotional videos. So that's
neat.
About that.
They do look, the videos look so good. The cameras now on these. Which drone do you have?
So we operate DJI products, including the Phantom 1, Phantom 2, and the S1000.
Mm. We have a DJI Phantom 1, the very first one, and have had great video from it. But I'd like to see the new ones look even better.
Yeah, the new Phantom has some really neat upgrades that really make the video much better.
How much?
Well, they have a gimbal system that it's designed better, so it's a smoother operating. The battery lasts a bit longer. And they also have the geofencing.
I like that. That keeps it from going outside of the range of the RC.
Yeah, really what it's designed for is to keep you out of airspace you shouldn't be in.
Oh, okay. So you could say, don't go here, don't go here.
Right. So you do the software upgrade, and you won't be able to fly at certain altitudes around airports, which protects everybody.
I think it's great. But these are $1,500.
Oh, that's just the beginning.
That's just getting started. Then you have to upgrade the camera and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and your audience should think if they're going to buy something, they need to think it's going to cost to operate twice or three times the amount of the initial
purchase. Oh, wow. That's good to know.
So you want to have extra batteries and that type
of thing. Now, is there a growing group of professional drone pilots out there?
Yeah. We're kind of trying to keep things on the down low just because the FAA and other agencies are not really straightforward and allowing people to be out and open and not get attention that they don't want. So they keep kind of quiet. But yeah, it's RC, and RC's been around for 30
years. Yeah, so somebody who's been doing a lot of that is probably going to be much better at that than you or I. That's why I'm starting with the cheap SEMA, the 50, because you have to be able to absorb the cost if you lose it or it crashes or... You know, I mean, if it's a $1,500 drone and your first flight you lose it, that's bad.
Yeah, and it doesn't look good if you've got an audience.
Yeah, it's also embarrassing. That's right. Hey, I really appreciate the tips. It's great to hear from you, Mark.
Yeah, well, hey, I appreciate your show, and just want to encourage everybody to always fly safely. And if you have a question of whether you should fly, you probably should.
Yes, don't go there.
Yeah.
Yeah. How long? Somebody said in the chat room, this is true. How long before somebody uses one of these quadcopters to buzz a sporting event? The thing is, you do something like that. Well, I guess they can't really shoot it down, although that would be tempting, wouldn't it? But you're really running a risk. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. Scott Wilkinson, our home theater guru, coming up next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Da 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 da. There's lots of interesting ones out here. So apparently $1,500 is nothing. What you really want is the DJI Inspire for only $3,000. What? 4K video, dual operator is kind of interesting. That's one of the things I've seen on some of the higher end newer ones is somebody to operate the camera as opposed to just controlling the quadcopter. Because you want somebody to steer. Scott Wilkinson is here, our home theater guru. He joins us each and every week to talk about, well, big screen TVs, surround sound, audio, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What do you got for us? Anything?
And plenty to talk about.
What's up? What's the latest? Well, of course, you're back from CES, but we talked last week about CES, I think.
We did, but
did we get everything in?
No, not by a long shot.
You mean we couldn't cover all of those acres of displays in an 8-minute segment?
Afraid not.
Oh. What is the thing with curved? Is that really real thing? I know everybody's doing it. Is there any reality to why they're doing it, or is it just to look different?
Well, I think it's just to look different, to tell you the truth. I mean, Samsung, in their press conference and all their press dealings, you know, said, oh, look at how many curved TVs we've sold. Over 60% of the UHD TVs we've sold are curved.
Right.
And I was thinking to myself, yeah, well, because that's all you
curved?
Make.
Yeah.
That's the only thing you make. Yeah. So, of course, it's going to be that way. I found it interesting that the Koreans are way into curves, and the Chinese, who get all their panels from the Koreans. So the Japanese brands are all still flat. So, you know, Samsung made an interesting announcement about that. They said their new SUHD TVs, which are these high dynamic range, wide color gamut sets that looked really fabulous, among my favorite pictures at the show. They have three lines, the JS9500, JS9000, and JS8500. And I said, well, are any of them going to be flat? And they said, well, you know what? The 8500, they are going to make flat for the U.S. market only. So it seemed to me that the demand from places like AVS Forum, where curved screens are almost universally rejected, perhaps influenced Samsung's decision to say, you know what, we better bring a flat one of these into the U.S. because a lot of people in the U.S. don't want curved. And AVS is a pretty significant forum, and it's got over 1 million members, so that perhaps says something. Maybe I'm just reading into it because I'm the editor of AVS. But anyway, so there's going to be one of those that's flat. And also LG's largest OLED 4K TV is one of these bendable models. So you can make it flat or curved, whatever you want. My concern is that motorization, that mechanization of that might cause a pretty hefty price premium. I don't know. They didn't announce prices. Samsung also had a bendable 105-inch, you know, one of their big jobs, but that's, you know, six figures. So, yeah, this whole thing with curved, I'm not convinced, except when it's in a big screen. TCL had a 110-inch curved LCD TV. They called it the world's largest 110-inch 4K UHD curved TV. To which I thought immediately, I wonder if there are any 110-inchers that are smaller than that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, wait a second. They didn't have their English quite right.
Well, as you know, I have a curved TV.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't hate it. It doesn't do any. I mean, it's just curved. It doesn't.
Yeah, yeah.
Have to sit in the middle, really, because it's not so curved. It's a few percentage.
The curve is gentle. Yeah. I agree. But the best seat in the house is in the middle.
Yeah. Which is a bad idea, right?
I think so, because I think home theater is much more of a communal experience.
And unless it's, if the middle seat were a lot better because it's curved, maybe. But it's not curved that much either. It's not curved to the periphery of your vision.
No. That's
it's just a little bit curved. Yeah. So it's kind of the worst of both worlds. It's like it doesn't improve the person sitting in the middle particularly, and it makes it harder for people who are not sitting in the middle. So, in other words, don't get curved. Good question from Ed in the chat room. Does it help with reflection?
No. In my opinion, it hurts reflection.
Oh.
Because it stretches out reflection.
Yeah, you know what? I see terrible reflections, come to think of it, in my curved TV.
You have a light somewhere. It's reflecting in the screen. If it's flat, it's a spot. If it's curved, it becomes a line.
Yeah.
I noticed that.
You're exactly right. Darn it. Now that you told me that, I'm going to see that every time.
You're going to see it all the time. I know.
Yeah, because instead of just a light, there's a line.
That's right.
Oh, man.
That's right. I see that all the time in the photos I take of these things when I use a flash. And I always go off axis when I take a photo of an LCD TV with a flash in particular. because usually with a flat screen, the flash will bounce off in the other direction.
Right.
But with a curved screen, you see this long line.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah, sad.
But as you point out, it's not likely to, you're going to get one without it if you're going in that direction of the high-end 4Ks.
Well, if you're going in for a Korean TV, and Samsung makes great TVs. Yeah. LG OLEDs are great. They looked fantastic.
The Sonys aren't curved.
No.
So the Japanese TVs are not.
That's right. Sharp, Panasonic, all are making flat TVs. The Panasonic OLED prototype at CES was curved. But that's not going to be a product this year.
Hmm.
So,
hey, you mentioned Cydia. Isn't that coming up?
Yeah, that's coming up in September.
Oh,
yes,
okay. So. I didn't mean to scare you.
Yeah, please. I'm kind of showed out at the moment. Oh, no, not another show.
Well, and this is, you know, we'll talk about this in not in your segment, but mobile phones weren't really in presence at CES because Mobile World Congress is coming up in a month, and that's
right.
Where they'll all be announced in early March.
And we should see a ton of that. I mean, LG, I think, announced one that had several different curve angles.
They're curving phones, too.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
That maybe makes sense because your face is curved.
Exactly. And they made that point in their press conference. And I wasn't paying that much attention because it wasn't a TV. But I did notice that they were saying, yeah, it's curved. It fits right around your face really nicely. We'll see. The other really cool thing that we didn't talk about last week, one other very cool thing, is Super MHL. Did anyone – I didn't cover it at the show.
I heard nothing about it.
Oh, man. Well, you know what MHL is, right?
I have MHL, but very few do, apparently.
It's
powered HDMI.
It's mobile HDMI, essentially.
Okay. Well, it's on my receiver.
Yeah.
Some TVs have it, too.
Some TVs have it. Some receivers have it. A lot of mobile devices have it.
Oh, interesting.
Smartphones and tablets and stuff. Well, at CES, I learned that they introduced Super MHL, and that looks like a beast. It's spec'd to carry 8K at 120 frames per second with 12-bit color. Now, this exceeds HDMI by leaps and bounds. It's amazing. It'll carry high dynamic range, extended color gamut, object-oriented audio. It's got a symmetrical connector, so you can plug it in either way. It's not, you know, I don't know if you've ever done this, but you try to plug in an HDMI cable the wrong way, and it's like, it's not going in.
The new USB is going to be that way, too. It's like a lightning cable. It doesn't matter how you plug it in.
Exactly.
Love
that. Exactly. So, but the fact that it can carry 8K, which certainly, I mean, we saw a couple of 8K TVs at CES, but that's not going to be anytime soon.
I hope not. 8K is ridiculous.
It is. Sharp showed it at 85 inches. So did Samsung, actually. Panasonic showed it at 55 inches. I couldn't believe it. A 55-inch TV at 8K.
You can't. It's beyond the range of human vision.
No, way beyond. Yeah. Way beyond. There's no purpose for that whatsoever.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thought that this Super MHL. Now, there's still some questions to answer that we don't know yet. But I got a spec chart from somebody who did go to there and visit their booth. And, man, it looks impressive.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
There you go. And there's tons more, too.
I'm sorry. I must have missed it. What this Super MHL, what are we going to do with it?
Who knows?
Okay. I didn't miss it. Hey, thank you, Scott Wilkinson.
You betcha.
You'll catch him at avsforum.com and on the Home Theater Geeks show at twit.tv. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Maybe that's why nobody said anything. We don't know what to do with it.
I had my timer on. And,
no, you knew. But there really isn't much to do with it, right? I mean, what are you going to do with it?
Well, what you're going to do with it is you're going to hope that, that it looks to me, the implication is that they're trying to expand beyond mobile applications into the home theater.
We already have mini HDMI that's on some mobile devices.
Right, but is it MHL?
But what does that matter?
Well, it turns out that I didn't know this either. MHL and HDMI are two different organizations.
No, that's what matters. It's a turf war. Hey, go ahead and talk. You take over.
It's sort of a turf.
I'm gonna. Go ahead. All yours.
Thank you. Thank you so much. iPhone 11339, 8K. Seriously, that's super epic. Well, sure, if you've got a 40-foot screen, it'd be super epic, but it makes no sense on a 55 or, you know, even an 85-inch screen. At CES, Sharp had this demo with text on the screen on this 8K set, and it got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and the guy standing next to the TV handed you a magnifying glass and said, can you read the smallest text? And the smallest text was, I don't know, one-point type or something tiny. And you go up there with the magnifying glass, and yep, you can read the type at 8K, which you couldn't at 4K. They had kind of a side by side, a split screen kind of comparison. But you know, am I gonna need to read 1-point type on my 8K TV? I don't think so. And standing at a kind of a semi normal distance from that TV, I mean, sure, it looked fantastic, but even at 85 inches at even 6 feet away, I don't think you can tell the difference between that and 4K, which is just now becoming not mainstream, but, you know, we've seen it for a couple of years now. Like I've said before, and I'll say again, the biggest news at CES was not 4K or 8K or the number of pixels on the screen. It was the fact that studios are now starting to create content, or talk about creating content anyway, that includes high dynamic range and wide color gamut that the TVs can reproduce properly. Now that you can see on any size screen from just about any distance away, and it makes a marked improvement, a huge improvement over current standard TV standards. And that is exciting to me. When we get that, when we get content coming into the home on 4K Blu-ray, Ultra HD Blu-ray, sorry, that's the name of it, or streaming, or any other way that it can come in, and it is graded, it is prepared, mastered for high dynamic range and wide color gamut, and it's played on a TV that can receive that information and reproduce it properly, you are going to see something really, really special, far beyond the best that can be done today. That's the key. That's the trick. Beatmaster asks, is Super MHL comparable to DisplayPort? And that's a great question. The answer is, yes, it is. And I'm looking at a comparison chart. And it's comparing Super MHL with DisplayPort 1.3. And I think 1.4 is coming out. And I don't know what that spec is. But it says DisplayPort 1.3 will do 8K at 60 frames per second with 8-bit color. So not 12-bit color and not 120 frames per second. It does not have a reversible connector. It does not do object-oriented audio, and it does not do high dynamic range.
So do you want to stick around for the top of the hour? Or?
Happy to.
Thank you, Scott.
You bet.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. So Gary Koffler just brought his little that's the Zima as well. This is the inexpensive quadcopter, $50. And you fly that around and you become skilled at it. Is that right, Gary? Nah. At least you don't cry if it ends up in the lake too hard. I have a feeling that that's one of the things that will be the natural Darwinian cap on the total number of quadcopters out there. I mean, imagine if everybody had one, it'd be a nightmare. But most people are going to lose them, break them, dump them in the lake. So one hopes that only the best pilots who are the most responsible will continue to fly their drones over our heads. 8888, Ask Leo. That's the phone number. Onto the phones. On with the phones. We go Julian in Los Angeles. Hi, Julian. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, good morning, Leo. So moving away from drones and TVs, which are fun, but kind of leaves us a little bit out as blind people, I want to share a new app that just came out this week that does a tremendous service to people who are blind. And as a mobile assistive technology trainer, I love sharing this kind of thing with patients and with the general public. It's a service called Be My Eyes, and the website is www.bemyeyes.org. And what this does is it connects a blind person to a network, which then connects them with a sighted volunteer who is, in effect, willing to be our eyes for any task, you know, for things like, for example, what's the what's the expiration date on this carton of milk, or that sort of thing. Color detection is another key thing here, because
that's great. Or even dollar bills, right? You could say, is this a 5 or a 10?
Yeah, you could, although we have apps that do that very quickly.
So interesting.
It's been available. So this is an
iPhone app.
Yeah, it's currently for the iPhone. However, I think they have a section there to deal with Android. And I think if enough Android blind users make noise, then we can get this over there as well.
You know, what's really interesting is the usage. There are 2,000 or 3,000 blind people using this and almost 30,000 sighted people who are helping, which is great. I love that.
Yeah, so it's great, not only to help a blind person, but if you're a sighted person in your spare time, you want to help the blind, somebody who might be homebound or disabled in another way that's not visual, that everybody can participate in this process.
So do you use this yourself?
Yes, I do.
That's so cool, Julian. So give me an example of how you've used it.
So, for example, I mentioned the carton of milk example, which is a good one. Normally, when I go grocery shopping, I can use barcode scanning apps to find out what products are. So I've been doing that for a while.
Okay.
But then the barcode doesn't tell you things like the expiration date or the price on the shelf or anything like that. So normally you either have to bug somebody near you or a store clerk or try to use other OCR apps to do that kind of thing. This makes it so it's a one-step process. So now if I'm going to look for milk, I can make a connection with the sighted person. I can walk over there. They can not only help me to find the right container of milk, so that saves me having to scan a bunch of barcodes, but then while we find the right one, I can say, oh, yeah, by the way, what's the expiration date on this? So it saves me a lot of time. And as I mentioned, color detection, there are apps that do that, but they don't do it as well as the human eye. So
that is so cool. So it's – and when you use it, do you find that there's almost always somebody there right away?
Yeah, it depends. It's a new thing, so sometimes there's a little bit of a delay on the network because everybody's hitting this all at once.
Right.
But, I think given the ratio that you mentioned, if things are functioning properly, it shouldn't take that long to make a connection.
That is so cool. 29,600 sighted people, 2,626 blind people, almost exactly 100 to 1.
Yeah.
Which I find interesting. And then 5,000... times that it's 5,000 people have been helped. So I am so glad you told me about this, Julian, and I'm going to definitely let others know about it. It's a free app, and what it really deserves, this is a really amazing example of what can happen with smartphones in the app ecosystem.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many things possible. In fact, if it's okay, can I mention my website? Where
yeah.
I do a podcast and other presentations, and it's all dedicated to teaching people how to use mobile technology. My website is www.tech, so T-E-C-H-J-V, J as in John, V as in Victor, .com.
Tech JV.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you for doing that.
Thank you, Leo.
And there's a nice picture of Julian right there. I love it. So nice to meet you. Portable assistive technology, training, consulting, and speaking. And I really appreciate your calling and telling us about that. That's great, Julian. I think you've just let a lot of people know about this. I bet that number of helpers will go up.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for the opportunity.
I'm gonna do it. That's awesome. Yeah. Thank you, Julian. Take care.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Jeffrey, Torrance, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Isn't that great?
Leo.
Hey, Jeffrey.
How you doing?
I'm great. Pick up the phone.
Okay. Sorry about that.
That's all right. It just sounds like you're giving a speech and... That's fine, but I...
So I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller.
Great to have you.
And I had some questions on a television. My wife and I were in the market for a Ultra HD. I mean, my son has one, and we really like the picture. Our Magnavox has finally
Okay, yeah, time for a new TV. How old is that Magnavox?
Magnavox,
actually. Yeah. Well, the name goes on before the quality goes in. Or is it the other way around? I can never remember. Wow, a Magnavox. Wait a minute. Let me get Scott Wilkinson here. He's still on the line, on the horn, because he can help you. Time for a new TV, right, Scott?
I saw that. I got you on Twit.
Good.
Man, oh, man. The quality goes in before the name goes on.
I had it backwards, I think, yeah. So let us help you. What do you need?
So, this is a plasma, and I don't know that gets really hot. I don't know what we should get. We're looking for like a 55 to 60 inch television.
Scott and I love plasmas for the display quality, but one of the reasons they're kind of disappearing, there's only one manufacturer left that still makes them, is because of this power issue. You know, they all have, and you can thank the state of California, they all have to meet power usage guidelines, and it's very difficult for a plasma to do so. So, Scott, who else is making plasmas?
Well, I don't.
Is anybody making them?
No. I think they're gone.
They're all gone.
There was not a single plasma at CES.
And yet, we love them. My Panasonic Viera is still my go-to TV. It's beautiful.
Yeah. My Pioneer Kuro, which is six years old now, you know, is my go-to.
Yeah.
But they don't.
My
make
ex-wife got that in the divorce.
Dang.
We fought over the Kuro, let me tell you.
Right.
The kids forget it, but the Kuro TV, now that was it.
Yeah. Well, what's your budget?
So, you know, we're looking at something around $1,000. I mean, we're gonna have this television probably for a while. This one, the plasma, that cost, you know, $1,700 way back when, you know?
Yeah, no, they used to, I remember when they cost $10,000.
That's right. The first ones, the first 42s are like $10,000. And you want something in the
42.
Yeah, you want something in a 55-inch, you say?
That's exactly right. Around 55, no bigger than 60, because we're only about 10 feet away from the television. So.
Oh, that's nice.
Well, in that case, I would get a 60 if you can fit it in.
Okay.
And I've been living for a while with a Vizio M series.
Those are very inexpensive, but very good,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah, it's a little. It's 60 inches, a little more than $1,000, I think. Depends on where
you... M series, you said?
Yeah. M as in Mary, 602i-B something. It's a 2014 model. It's probably dash B3, but that last number changes with software revs and so on. It's an LCD TV, full array backlit with local dimming. Now, it doesn't have that many zones. It only has like 32 zones. I don't really notice them pumping or working, except possibly when a show fades to black, it might, for a moment, you might see one zone a little brighter than the other. It doesn't bother me at all. In regular content material, it's not a problem.
You're talking about how the backlighting is handled.
How the backlighting is handled,
yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Generally speaking, though, I really like this TV. I recommend it. Again, a 60-inch. Now, there's a difference between the 60 and the 55, and the difference is the 60 uses what's called a vertical alignment panel, which gives you better blacks but poor off-axis response, whereas the 55-inch gives you not as good black but better off-axis response. So if you sit off-axis a lot, if you have a lot of people over and they're occupying a wide viewing angle, the 55-inch might be better. I don't have any personal experience with it. But if you're mostly sitting in the middle of that screen, I would get the 60 and the vertical alignment panel.
Other thing with this television, Scott, the one we have, it doesn't have any HDMI ports. So,
you
can't get anything now. You know?
Yeah, Magnavox. Yeah. They didn't have HDMI back then.
No, they
have a port for your VCR. Hey, we're out of time. Thank you, Scott Wilkinson. And I'm glad you could call in while Scott was still here. Hope you enjoy your new TV. You're welcome, Jeffrey. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Under 1,000 at Amazon. The M602i. 60-inch, which is probably the minimum he should get at that distance, right?
Correct. Yeah. 70 is actually the optimum.
Yeah. Yeah,
but 60 would be fine. Now, is that the 601M601i-B something?
Oh, God. You and your... Yes.
Good. That's important, because the A is not nearly as good, the 2013 model.
60...
That B is important.
Oh, no, it's a 6... Oh, I don't know. Here. That's that one. 60... It's a B3.
There you go. That's it. It's the one I've got.
$998. That's very affordable.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to go to 70, it's $15.95. So go to 70. Hey, you get Amazon Prime on 80. Go to 80. Then there's $3,000, but the shipping's free. Get that TV. 80 inches. Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
Vizio, you know, Vizio does a great job.
I wish I needed a new TV.
Oh, you know what? Lewis in Hollywood has it right. That was Zenith. The quality goes in before the name goes on.
Cares?
It wasn't Magnavox.
That nobody remembers but Lewis and me and you.
Right. Now, Lewis, was it Zenith or Magnavox that first came out? I think it was Zenith that first came out with a clicker. I remember at my grandparents' house, they had an old, I think it was a Zenith, with an ultrasonic remote control such that, and what it did was
you clicked it. It's so weird. You push it and go, thump.
Right. But it had actual ultrasonic tuning forks in it. And that thunk was a hammer hitting a tuning fork that vibrated ultrasonically. And the TV changed channels at one ultrasonic frequency and turned the volume up and down at another ultrasonic frequency.
So they still make TVs. Look at this.
Smart.
I'm thinking. Very smart. Yeah, I'm thinking they probably sold the name. Oh, it's a registered mark of Philips.
Ah,
it's made by Funai.
Right. Philips sold their whole TV business to Funai. And then very recently at CES this year, a little bit before, I think, they changed again. It's now PNF or something. I don't know. They showed a very weird hybrid at CES, a TV that uses red lasers and red and cyan lasers. I didn't see it. But it was an actual LCD TV using lasers for backlight. It was over, I forget, it might have been at the Renaissance, and I didn't even hear about it till after the show. But on Home Theater Geeks last Thursday, I had a panel on of journalists to do a CES wrap-up. And we're actually doing part two next week because there was so much
to talk.
I saw
that. That was so good with Robert and...
Robert Heron and Mike Heiss and Mark Henninger. Absolutely, yeah. And we didn't get to everything, so we decided... Sort of the good news is that my guest for next week dropped out last Thursday. Called me and said, I'm going to be at the NAMM show.
It's okay. We didn't want you anyway. Go away.
No. We do want him. He's very good. He's going to be great. He's going to be on the first Thursday of February. But that gave me the option to bring the panel back for part two. So we're going to talk a lot more about audio, for one thing, and some other stuff, too. I could have talked about on the show today... this Meridian MQA compression process, they wouldn't want me to call it that, but it is, for high-res audio, the Tidal. Are you familiar with an audio streaming service called Tidal, T-I-D-A-L?
Yeah, they're brand new. This is the high-res audio streaming.
Yes, and at the moment, high-res means uncompressed CD quality.
Right.
But they're going to be using MQA soon to stream 24.1 up to 24.192.
That's intriguing. Now, yeah, Tidal and Deezer both say we're going to do higher quality, uncompressed.
Right. Using it, I know Tidal is, maybe Deezer as well, using MQA.
Deezer's been around in Europe for a long time.
You know, and I think they might even be the same company, and they're just bringing it to the U.S.
Oh, maybe that's it. Maybe that's a different name.
Yeah, I suspect that's true.
Yeah.
Uncompressed 24.192 audio, stereo audio, is like almost 8 gigabits per second, or megabits.
Yeah, so Deezer's doing FLAC, but it's CD quality.
CD quality. Tidal is going to do higher than FLAC, higher than CD quality, using this MQA, which drops the bit rate by a factor of 8.
Yeah.
Without losing quality.
See, that's what we need, because the problem is people may not want to use up that much bandwidth all the time.
Right.
Tidal. Right. Huh? So when are they going to do that? That makes me more interested in Tidal.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if they announced a schedule.
TidalHiFi.com.
Oh, is that what it is? I thought would it be just Tidal.com, but TidalHiFi. Okay.
TidalHiFi.com.
T-I-D-A-L. I'm very excited about it. I only learned about it at CES, but at the Venetian, where all the high-end audio demos were, it was supplying the music to a lot of high-end audio demos.
Yeah.
I was amazed, actually.
So Spotify uses Vorbis at 320. iTunes uses 256 kilobit AAC. Tidal's using CD quality. You should uncompress CD quality. There's no question it's better than MP3 or AAC.
No question about it.
You might debate the high res, and a lot of people think I'm nuts. But nobody. Oh, you even get music videos from this. That's interesting.
Oh, yeah? Interesting.
Hmm.
when I was at
20 bucks a month. It's twice as much.
Yeah, it's pretty expensive.
Yeah.
When I was at the Harman booth, who should show up but Neil Young?
Wow, neat.
Yeah.
Did you say hi?
No, he had a phalanx of an entourage around him. I couldn't get close.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what it's like for a guy like that. He walks around the show and he has a photographer and a videographer recording everything he does.
Yeah. Well, it's his choice. I'm sure he doesn't have to do that.
No. It's true.
They do ALAC, Apple Lossless on iOS, mm-hmm. and they do FLAC on everything else. It's interesting.
Well, so I don't know when this MQA, they're going to start doing that, but I'm pretty interested in this MQA. I think it's pretty cool.
So it's about double the bandwidth of an AAC stream currently.
What is an AAC stream? What's the bandwidth? I know that MQA...
Well, if it's the AAC that Apple uses, 256 kilobits per second.
Right. MQA, if it encodes a 24/192 stereo stream, its bandwidth is 1 megabit.
Okay.
So it's higher than AAC.
Yeah.
But it's lossless. And I've heard people say, compare the Direct 192 to the MQA, and they say they like the MQA better. It's not even that it's compressed and it's pretty good.
Yeah, they say on this Tidal FAQ, they say, obviously, FLAC gets decoded to PCM.
Right.
And they say PCM is a region of 700 to 900 kilobits per second. So it's a little bit lower than a megabit, but it's CD quality as opposed to high res.
Right. Stereo CD, I thought, was 1.4 megabits uncompressed. Just
it is,
PCM.
But what they're saying is because... Since PCM has a variable bit rate by nature, our experience from our testing is a lot of the repertoire is in the region of 700 to 900 kilobits.
Oh, how interesting. Okay, yeah. So that's the effective bit rate.
Right.
Huh, interesting.
All right, thank you, Scotty. Have a great weekend.
Hey, my pleasure.
Thanks
See you
for
later.
Sticking around.
Bye. You bet.
Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk about computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, anything with a chip in it. This is the place to come. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number to call. 888-827-5536. That's toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. If you're outside those areas, you can call via Skype, at least for now, if you're not in the U.K. Did you hear David Cameron, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, very upset? He's using the French terrorist attack against Charlie Hebdo, the magazine, as an excuse, frankly, to, and this often happens, to step up state surveillance. And in the case of the UK, he says it's not right that there should be any communications that we as the government of the United Kingdom cannot see, cannot look into. And what he says is the fact that terrorists can use Apple's messages or Skype or WhatsApp or any of the dozens and dozens of programs out now that encrypt your messages so that only you and the person they're intended to reach can read it, that the government, the UK government, can't read. He says that's not going to happen. We are going to stop that. He says, you don't have to worry because we won't be able to read people's messages unless there's a warrant signed by the Home Secretary. So no problem. This, of course, got the attention of a lot of people all over the world saying, what? I think they do that in China and not very well, I might add. There are countries that try to prevent encrypted transactions. But nobody in the United States has called for this lately. Actually, I take it back. I think the head of the FBI said that, Comey, just the other day. He said, you know, we shouldn't allow encrypted. Now, it's very easy for you to send an encrypted email using free and open source software like OpenGPG or even commercial software, S/MIME, and most email packages will allow you to send an encrypted message from you to the recipient that no one, not even the federal government, can read. Now, of course, they're saying, well, look, see, terrorists now are going to be able to communicate with one another, and we'll have no means of looking into those communications. We can't eavesdrop on them. So that sounds, on the face of it, legitimate, especially in the face of terrorist threats. But there's some points to be made about this. First of all, If you put, and what he's proposing is that, no problem, you can use WhatsApp. We're just going to ask the people who make it to give us a backdoor key into it so that we can look at what you're saying. Just us, don't worry. The problem is, of course, that really means they're weakening it. And it's been the experience over many years that if there is a backdoor, that it isn't just the governments that will be able to take advantage of it. Bad guys, spies, voyeurs will likely find the backdoor and be able to spy on your stuff as well. There's also the issue of, can the United Kingdom kind of unilaterally say, well, we're going to make Apple and Microsoft and Google and everybody else change their software so that we can see into it? These aren't British companies. I suppose because they operate in Britain, they do have to adhere to British laws, but to weaken their technology. And by the way, it would weaken it not just for people in the UK. It'd have to weaken it for us, too. And don't you think we deserve privacy? Oh, incidentally, people working in the British government do have strong encryption that no one can see into. Well, but we trust them. That's okay. It's just you we don't trust. People were very nervous about this. Very nervous about this in the security community, the tech community. It would make Britain an island once again, a technology island, because of course some companies would withdraw entirely, others would I guess break their software, which would hurt them around the world. I just don't see this. I frankly don't think if he was serious about it, and I question that, but if he was serious about it, he has by now learned that this is a non-starter, that Parliament is never going to agree to this. He is visiting right now with President Obama, apparently to ask his help in going to U.S. tech firms to enforce such a ban on encryption. That ain't going to happen. And if it did pass as a law here or in the U.K., and I'm sure that there are lawmakers in the United States, certainly the FBI would love this, the widespread civil disobedience and the availability of open source free programs that do provide security, like TextSecure, you can download TextSecure on almost any platform, use it, and no government can read what you're doing. And how are they going to stop that? So I hope that it's a non-starter. There are those in the UK who believe that it is in fact going to happen. If it does, it's a mess. And it's not going to happen. It can't happen. We tried. There's some history in this. The United States tried to prevent. When strong encryption was created here in the U.S., and by the way, it's very easy to implement. It doesn't take a rocket science to implement strong encryption that even governments can't crack. When it was created here in the U.S., the U.S. government classified it as munitions and said it may not be exported. That didn't work so well. There were people wearing T-shirts. It was so easy to implement that you could actually write the code in a few lines on a T-shirt. There are people who made T-shirts that they crossed the border, the U.S. border, with the code for creating strong encryption on it. It was a law that was so widely broken that they stopped enforcing it. They would have loved to continue to enforce it, I'm sure. But it's like nuclear proliferation. It's kind of hard to keep a lid on it once the word goes out. And it's a lot easier than creating an atomic bomb. Any computer science student can figure it out and do it. So I know a lot of people are very worried, and we'll certainly keep an eye on this in the UK because it would impact us here in the US. But as of now, everybody in the UK and the US has, and probably most people listening, unless you live in Turkey or China or Russia perhaps, has the right to strong encryption. And even in those countries, by the way, where they do try to shut it down, they haven't been able to effectively. It's maybe a good time to download that GPG program, start that email encryption policy. Start using secure text messaging. WhatsApp is secure. Apple's Messages is secure. I like to use open source programs if I can, because a company like Apple, Microsoft, Google can assert, there's no backdoor for the government. But you can't look at the code, so you don't know for sure. There's no way of knowing for sure. You just have to trust them. So I far prefer using open source encryption technologies like GPG, because you can look at the code. People are looking at the code and saying, is there a backdoor for the government? No, it's good. Using open source encryption is always a better idea, in my opinion. And it exists. But we'll watch that, because certainly it would be a huge error for the British government to pursue that. And I know that's this is pretty geeky stuff, but it's important for us, I think, to know about it and to keep an eye on it. Let's go to Dan in Huntington Beach, California. Hi, Dan. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. How are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Doing great. Listen, I had a 50-inch Pioneer plasma that I bought for $3,005, and I still love it, but that's not why I'm calling.
All right. That's great.
I have an iPad 1 and an iPad 2. Both my wife and I are working professionals, and I'm getting tired of pulling out my computer, my laptop, and using that for email at home. And I'm searching for a keyboard that's portable, that's that can connect via Bluetooth, and is not a clamshell, but something that can sit on a table and we can both use the same keyboard.
So any Bluetooth keyboard, and there are many, will work with an iPad, including Apple's own little one. There are a number of companies that make keyboards that are cases for the iPad. Logitech is my favorite, but there are a lot of companies that do this now. So the iPad goes in a case. The keyboard's part of the case. You said you don't want that.
No.
Well, then any Bluetooth keyboard, I would look at the Apple Bluetooth keyboard, which is compact, lightweight, and works very well and works great with an iPad. It turns this turns the iPad into a laptop, doesn't it? So there's lots of choices out there. I like Logitech for the clamshell, Apple for the regular. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our show today brought to you by our good buddies at ZipRecruiter. You know, I didn't realize this. Randall Schwartz works at ZipRecruiter now. He does a lot of their code for them. Isn't that great? Another reason to like them. We used ZipRecruiter when we had a job opening and had great results. ZipRecruiter, the idea of ZipRecruiter is you're posting. If you work in a business where you need to hire people. And the good news is the internet makes that much easier thanks to all the job boards out there. But do you know which job board to post to? Each of them has a different constituency, different strengths and weaknesses. Wouldn't it be cool to post your job on every job board, 50-plus job boards, with a single click of the mouse? Wouldn't that be awesome? ZipRecruiter.com, that's what it does. You post your job to 50-plus job sites and all the social sites like Craigslist and LinkedIn and Twitter, Facebook. The beauty part of this is they'll handle the responses. You're not going to get a zillion emails or phone calls. ZipRecruiter has an easy-to-use interface. You'll be able to quickly screen the candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find candidates in any city, any industry, anywhere. You just post once and find those candidates rolling in. 250,000 businesses, including Twit, have used ZipRecruiter. It's so easy to use. In fact, we've set it up so you can try it free. Look at all the companies that use ZipRecruiter. I got to get the Twit logo on there. Dell, Aveda, Habitat for Humanity, Macy's, Netflix, VW, AT&T, TiVo, Pandora. So traditional big businesses, small businesses, startups. 4-day trial free. All you have to do is go to ZipRecruiter.com/tech guy. ZipRecruiter.com/tech guy. Oh, he's still talking. Oh, that Leo's still talking. All right, here's a chat room has a suggestion for a keyboard. Let me pull that up. iDownload blog. Oh, interesting. Yeah, I have something like this, actually. I got in China that folds up. I'm not a fan of them, but if you want... And there are a lot of these on the eBay, and I'm sure Amazon has them too, of folding Bluetooth keyboard. Those are certainly more compact. Let me show you a couple of them. Hey, Amazon, I'm talking to you. Folding Bluetooth keyboard. These are all, pretty much the same. This is the one that I got from China. So it folds up into like a cigarette case or something. And then you unfold it, and boom, it works with it. So you don't have to look for something that works with iOS. If you get one this is the one I gave John, exactly. The iLipo, $50. If you get one that says it's made for iPhone, then it'll have the right Apple keys and everything. You may not care about that. Certainly the Apple one will. iLepo, the first global chocolate foldable keyboard high touch full chocolate. Why do they call it chocolate? Is that so you'll just find it in the word chocolate when you search for chocolate? That's interesting. There's a lot of these. I like the Logitech Ultra Slim iPad keyboard case, I think is what it's called. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number, 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Mike is next in Sherman Oaks, California. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing, sir?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you for asking. That two-part question and an unrelated one. How do you properly delete a program off of a laptop or a computer? And after that, I know once you delete a program, they have hidden files inside the computer. How do you find those on the laptop?
So the best way to uninstall a program is to use the uninstaller that came with the program. It's going to at least know, you know, in theory, what the installer did and reverse it. In fact, on Windows, there's a manifest created by the installer that says everything it did. It says, well, I did, and by the way, everything can be a lot of things, of course. And this is the problem. Sometimes people say, oh, I see the file. It made a folder in the program's folder. I'm just going to delete that folder, right? No, because it's also putting DLLs, libraries, in other folders, including your main Windows folder. It's modifying your registry. It's doing a lot of things. So ideally, the uninstaller would look at the manifest created by the installer, and this is most of the time how it works, and remove all traces. Sometimes the uninstallers aren't well done, and they leave some traces behind. It's not the end of the world. That's one of the reasons.
So just go with the uninstaller.
Absolutely. Always use the uninstaller that came with the program. Now, if it didn't come with the program, there used to be, and I presume there still are, uninstaller programs you can buy that claim to do the same thing. In fact, if you keep them running all the time, I don't recommend this, by the way, but we used to do this a lot. You'd keep it running in the background, watching all the installs. Then it would make its own manifest, which in theory would be even better than the one made by the original program because it's watching. Ah, I saw you do that. So, yeah, they still make them. Revo makes one that's it's free, so I guess that's the one to look at. Again, I far prefer you use the uninstaller that came with the program. Maybe if you want to get, you know, really finicky, OCD about it, you might want to run the Revo uninstaller again because it'll scan for leftovers. I really think the days of uninstallers, you know, third-party uninstaller programs are gone. But there are cases. For instance, I'll give you a great example. Both McAfee and Symantec, the antivirus companies. By the way, McAfee's owned by Intel, which has dumped the McAfee name. Symantec used to be Norton, but they dumped the Norton name. But in both cases, and this is true often of security software, the uninstaller that comes with it doesn't do a great job. I think partly that's because they don't want the bad guys to be able to uninstall components and let the antivirus go away while they continue to work. So both McAfee, I presume Intel's doing this now that they own it, and Symantec have separate uninstaller programs you can download from their website that will go the extra yard. Why this is better is beyond me. I mean, couldn't a bad guy just do the same? Say, let me borrow that code and put that in my malware? I don't know why not. So my strong recommendation is go to the control panel, the programs and features control panel, uninstall. I don't think it's a good idea. Somebody in the chat room said, then I go through the registry. I don't think that's a good idea. You can so easily mung up a computer. And I know we're all very OCD about this, but having leftover little bits in your registry is not the end of the world. It really isn't. I shake my fist at Microsoft for coming up with this pathetic idea. The registry was it Windows 95? I think that's when they first came up with this idea of here's what we should do. Instead of just putting files in the operating system or whatever, or having configuration files or, you know, text files that somebody could easily see and edit and delete, let's create this giant hairball of a file. It's actually a couple of files We'll call it the registry. And you can't see into it. It's a black box. You can, with a registry editor, read it. But, oh, and by the way, any changes made to the registry take effect immediately. So if you, delete something accidentally in the registry editor, you could make your machine unbootable immediately. It was just a terrible idea. And the registry files, of course, do, and this is the one reason you might want to clean them up, do get big. And after they get bigger than 2 gigabytes on many machines, it'll stop working. So this is probably the primary source of what we've often called on Windows bit rot, the idea that after you use the operating system for a while, it gets slower and bad and unreliable. A lot of that, I think, is due to the registry. I don't recommend registry cleaners because of the either they're overly aggressive and then there's a big risk, or they're not aggressive enough and there's no benefit. It's hard to find the right middle ground. Best thing to do, that's when Windows starts getting unreliable and slow, just reinstall. Just start over. It's not such a big deal. And that's the reason why Windows is often, is fixed by just every few years, just redo the whole thing. You'll be glad you did. So I don't actually generally recommend uninstallers, registry cleaners, and all of those. It's really far better to just, if you really, first of all, OCD is bad. Don't get crazy about every little thing on your computer. It will drive you mad. Because you can't get rid of all the little bits. You cannot dust the insides of a computer and get it all clean. You can't. Just pretend it's fine. Just turn your back to it. There's no such thing as a perfect PC. And then periodically, if you really do say, I know I have to have spring cleaning, the best thing to do is format the drive and reinstall everything. And only install the things you use. Because over 3 or 4 years, you've installed a lot of stuff you never used again. Just only install the stuff you have to have as needed. Works great. Apple used to be that you could just drag the file out of the applications folder and that would be it. Because Apple does provide a mechanism for files. What looks like a file is actually not a single application file, but a folder with lots of stuff in it. But unfortunately, as OS X has progressed, more and more you're seeing changes to other parts of the hard drive. There's no registry, thank goodness, but there's other things that, application data folders and things that can get jammed up with stuff that doesn't go away with an uninstall. On the other hand, I think with an Apple, if you on a Macintosh, just delete the file, you're 90% there. Don't worry about the other 10%. There are app uninstallers. I don't recommend them. I really don't. Rob in Tarzana, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Leo. Would you like a recommendation for your caller that inquired about the keyboard, or should I just get to my subject?
I would love a recommendation. Then we'll take a break, and you can ask your question.
Beautiful. Okay. And this came from an associate of mine that was using it, and I tried his, and I loved it, and bought it, and I love it also. It's a Kensington keyboard with a folio, and it's called the Keyfolio Pro 2.
All right.
It's a removable keyboard, case, and stand. And it's got the chiclets on it, so it feels like you're actually tapping a real keyboard, and it feels very natural and very good to use with an iPad.
That's great to know.
Yeah.
It is like the Logitech, a case, as opposed to a standalone keyboard.
Precisely.
Yeah. Good.
Precisely. And
now,
it feels great, and you can pick your color of case, too.
About $100 as are most of these. Good recommendation. Hang on. We'll get your question right after this break. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Johnny Jett's here. He is our travel guru at johnnyjett.com. He helps us use technology to get the most out of travel. Hello, Johnny.
Hello, Leo.
It's always fun to figure out where Johnny has been and where he is going. The last time we talked, you were in L.A., I think, but you said you were going to go somewhere where it was a 40 degrees colder.
60.
60. Where was that?
It was Toronto.
Ah, where your wife lives.
Yeah, it was zero, -2 Fahrenheit.
Yikes. But I've been there when it's that cold. It's just, your tongue hurts.
I didn't go outside.
Oh, yeah. Well, don't go outside.
I actually didn't even bring a jacket, which was the first time I ever brought a jacket.
What are you, nuts?
Because I didn't go outside. Although I usually recommend bringing a jacket in case something goes wrong. I just was then going to Florida. And I only do carry on, and the jacket is so bulky that I.
Yeah, and who needs a jacket in Delray Beach?
I rolled the dice.
And it worked.
It did. And I just landed. I took an 8:30 a.m. flight this morning from Palm Beach. There's a nonstop on American. Landed here at 11. Crazy. And cruise to my house.
I like Palm Beach area. I haven't been to Delray. I like Palm Beach, though.
Oh, Delray Beach is actually, Delray Beach is now changing. It's getting too big. They just put Urban Outfitters in there. I was like, there's trouble now.
That's trouble. Yeah. Do you ever go to Key West?
I've been to Key West, and actually, I was I was going to delay my flight and go to Cuba.
Can you do that now?
Well, you can't legally. Still, I mean, they've definitely loosened it up yesterday even more. But you're still supposed to be going for, you know, one of the 12 reasons. I don't know what them all are, but, you know, either humanitarian.
Right. And or cultural exchange, humanitarian or cultural exchange.
Yeah,
I know people who do that. Sometimes they go through Canada or Mexico. But we are normalizing relations. So at some point.
It's going to open up big time. And people are already starting to go. Illegally, even though you know, they just don't think they're rolling the dice and hoping they're not going to get fined.
Right.
So, because you get a big fine if you do go illegally. That's why I have not gone.
I'm not going until it's okay.
You can now use credit cards in Cuba, although I hear that there's not a lot of places where they take them. You got to still bring cash, but you can only bring $100 worth of cigars.
I want to go and take pictures and kind of capture it before it goes back to the Cuba.
That's what I want to go.
The 50s, where it's all casinos and, you know, it becomes Miami Beach, you know, west or east.
For sure.
So what do you got for us?
So last week you asked me about a website where you can get airline reviews.
Yeah.
Sort of like TripAdvisor. I mentioned Route Happy, which does on specific flights. So if you put in, let's say you put in Palm Beach to LA, the number one thing will come up is American Airlines, because they're the only one that has a nonstop flight out of there. But it also, you know, it gives it a 7.7 review out of 10. And, you know, some of the reasons why it doesn't have a 10 is because they charge for bags, they charge for food, they don't have a lot of leg room and things like that. So they rate it by the airline. But the other website that I did not mention and I was trying to think of and I spaced, which was airlinequality.com.
Oh,
it's Skytrax. And it's an air travel rating and review system. So you can type in the airline. I just typed in JetBlue, and there was 387.
So this is reviews. Kind of like TripAdvisor or Yelp, where people – these are reviews from the public.
Exactly.
Got it.
So, again, you know, the problem with these reviews, you have no idea who they are, if you can trust them. So
– and if it's something like Macedonian Airlines, apparently there are no reviews. Oh, wait a minute. No, there are. Holy cow. There are reviews of Macedonia. I have never in 15 years of flying experienced such an unprofessional outfit. From the Macedonia Airlines office in Ohrid, the staff on the ground in Skopje and Ohrid, you get straight-faced lies, lies.
That was 2007. I don't think they're in business
anymore. This must be fun to read. The most unreliable airline I have ever traveled with. They have no morals or understanding of customer relations. Oh, this is fun.
I think they shut down.
Yeah. Yeah. They probably have after those reviews. And actually, there are quite a few good ones after that. So I just read the bad ones. So that's kind.
Yeah,
they
shut down.
Yeah. That's why I read that one. I wasn't going to read it. I'm not crazy.
I got you. So you can get an idea of what the airline's like if you've never heard of it. And that's one way to do it. Skytrax is actually pretty popular in terms of ranking the best airlines in the world. And all the airlines always jump on it. And they send press releases out and saying, we're just rated number one by Skytrax and the airports as well. And they actually do a pretty good job on some of those. So I just never check out the reader reviews.
So they have – this is good. This is good.
But they have 681 airlines and 725 airports.
Neat. So even though it's called Skytrax, it's airlinequality.com.
Com, exactly. So I got an app for you too.
Yes, yes.
This one's an interesting one. So my wife and I were on vacation kind of in Hawaii a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I remember that.
And we're having dinner at the Chart House.
Yeah.
In Waikiki, I was walking out and something caught my attention. I look in the table next to me. The guy has his iPhone up on the table.
Yeah.
And there's a fireplace app going. You know, I've seen the fireplace TV channel and the aquarium channel before. And actually, we used it in Canada over Christmas, the fireplace channel. because my wife's mother does not have a fireplace, so they put the channel on. I was like, this is ridiculous. And then all of a sudden I find out there's an app.
There's an app for that.
And I thought it was – I don't think I would do it, but some people might like to do it. They go to a restaurant and they put the little fireplace app, and you can hear the crackling and the roar of the fire.
Oh, that's hysterical.
And the best part besides being free is that you don't have to chop the wood.
It's not free. It's 99 cents on iOS.
Wait, is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's all right. A buck for a fireplace that never needs logs, full screen, crackling fire. They have an iPad version, too. It would be better on the iPad.
For sure.
Yeah. Look at that. Johnny Jett. You're crazy. Go to johnnyjett.com. That's his website. By the way, a great travel newsletter that's free. You should subscribe because he'll give you travel deals like nobody's business. It's johnnyjett.com. Follow him on Twitter, at johnnyjett. For more great travel tips, make sure you check out his lists, too. He has lists of every airline. It's a really, you know, a lot of wonderful, useful lists you can subscribe to on Twitter. He's also on Instagram. That's how I know what he's up to. I follow his pictures on Instagram, at Johnny Jett. Thank you, Johnny.
Thank you. Have a great week.
You, too. Where are you going? Are you going to stay home for a little while?
Actually, no. Next week, I will be in a different location. And I might be flying, so I have to double check. I might be changing my flight.
Oh, man, this guy just is – you look up peripatetic in the dictionary, and you get Johnny Jett.
That's what I do.
Never sit still. Thank you, John.
Take care. Have a great week.
At Johnny Jett, johnnyjett.com. Let's get back to Rob, who's been hanging on very patiently in Tarzana. Thank you, Rob, for your patience.
Oh, well, thank you, Leo. My job puts me on the road quite a bit, and I want to access my desktop PC in my home from either my Windows laptop that I carry with me,
yep,
or from my iPad. I can download a program to help me with this on my home base, you know, on my computer at home, but I don't want to download a program onto my laptop or to my iPad. And I'm familiar with programs like Log Me In and
right, TeamViewer. Yeah.
Go to my PC, all yeah. that. Yeah, TeamViewer.
But you need those programs on your iPad. You're saying you want to do it in the browser, I guess.
Yes. Is there anything browser related? And as far as my Windows PC, it belongs to my company, and they won't let me install.
I see.
Yeah.
I see.
I'm not sure.
I don't know. That's a good question. We're going to take a break, and I will do some research. Maybe the chat room can help me. Appless remote access on an iPad? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I feel like he's going to have to install something, even if it's a Chrome extension. I don't think I would be surprised if there's anything appropriate on the iPad, because they're not going to let you use the browser to do something like that. It would have to be HTML5 based. We're talking with the chat room, in case you couldn't tell, Rob. Google Chrome Remote. Now, I don't know if they will let him install Chrome extensions on his Windows machine. My guess is if he can't install apps, he won't be able to install extensions. But let's look at this. Yeah, no, TeamViewer requires an installation, though, right? You can't do it in a browser. Google Chrome Remote. All right. No, it's not free. Free is not the issue. He can't install anything on his laptop. No, I understand.
I like your shirt.
Thank you. He can't install anything. So it has to be something that will work without installing anything. Now, maybe he can install a Chrome. TeamViewer can run from an EXE. No, you're still not getting it. No, but it'll run from an EXE. You don't have to install it. No, I understand. That's installing it. If he can install Chrome extensions, he could for sure do it. So those are the two ways to do it. Does VNC have a web client? What you want is something that has an HTML5 client. Guacamole. Clientless remote desktop gateway. No plugins or client software. Thanks to HTML5, you install Guacamole at home, and all you need on your laptop. Look at that. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So we're talking with Rob. He has an interesting puzzler. It's a good one. He wants to be able to access his home PC from the road, either on an iPad or a Windows laptop. But wait, that would be easy, of course. But wait, he's not allowed to install anything on his Windows laptop because it's locked down by IT, right? They probably, Rob, don't let you even use... I would guess don't let you use RDP, the remote desktop protocol, which some versions of Windows come with. But lo and behold, I have found something that uses VNC. VNC is a well-known standard for this kind of thing. And here's an open source project called Guacamole. Guac-dev.org. guac-dev.org. And Guacamole works in an HTML5 browser. And this is means that on your Windows laptop, you wouldn't have to install anything. You might even, I don't know how complete the HTML5 implementation is on iPad's Safari browser. My guess is it may be complete enough to do this as well. So what a clever idea. A clientless remote desktop gateway. And it supports RDP, which is the Windows remote desktop, but also VNC, which is the open source. And this is free. So I haven't used it, but that's exactly what you need. You need something that's going to do it in your native browser without adding any extensions, I presume, or installing any apps. Very clever. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. Moving on. Donald, Chicago, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Donald.
How's it going, Leo?
It's going well. How are you?
Doing good. I'm looking for a tablet. It's going to be my first tablet, and I'm wondering what you think about the Surface Pro 3.
Love it. It's more a computer or a laptop than a tablet, you understand?
Mm-hmm.
So as sold, it is just a tablet. They don't even include the keyboard. This is Microsoft's hardware. It's a beautiful screen. A lot of people, people who rate screens say it's the best screen of any tablet out there. Very good screen. But it's a little thicker and heavier than like an iPad because it's full Windows. And then if you buy the type cover, which clicks into it, now you've got a laptop computer. So I would say the Surface Pro 3 is a good choice for somebody who wants kind of mostly a laptop, but the ability sometimes to detach the keyboard and use it as a tablet.
Okay.
It's your first tablet. So, I mean, it's also expensive, by the way. We're talking well over $1,000.
Yeah.
So it's your first tablet. So I guess I would ask you, why do you want a tablet? What do you want to do with a tablet?
I want something to be able to watch movies on, stuff like that. That's bigger than my phone, but yet smaller than the laptop.
You want to watch movies?
Yeah,
okay.
To be able to like take it out in a vehicle, well, going on trips to watch movies.
And where do you get the movies? Are these movies that you have on DVD that you're ripping, or are you just going to buy movies on a store, rent movies on a store?
Pretty much like movies that I've ripped and stuff.
Okay, so a PC is a good choice for that because something like an iPad, while it's possible to copy rip movies over, iPad would be great if you were just watching movies from the iTunes store, you know, renting movies and streaming them. If you wanted to do the Amazon store, the cheapest laptop out there, and we're talking a couple hundred bucks, is a Kindle Fire. Actually, they don't call them Kindles anymore. They just call them Fires, the Amazon Fire tablet. I mean, we're talking a couple hundred bucks. Great for watching movies from Amazon store, but a little harder to watch movies that you get from other sources or your ripped DVDs. For that, anything that you wanted to do that with, you would either need an easy way to move movies over or, better yet, an SD card slot, which the Surface Pro 3 has. So you can, on your computer at home where you've got all your DVDs ripped, copy those files to an SD card, pop it into your Surface Pro, and you're ready to watch them.
Okay.
That's probably the – so in that case, yes, but it's a lot more expensive. Now we're talking $1,200.
Yeah.
So Surface is great if you want – a laptop, a good laptop, with the latest version of Windows. But what if you're saying, I just want to watch movies, yeah, there are less expensive. I think what we need to do is find you a tablet that has an SD card. You could probably save $500 or $600 by doing that.
There'll be movies surfing the web.
Yeah, they all can surf the web. What about, you know what, I kind of like the NVIDIA Shield, which is a pretty fast portable, they call it gaming tablet. Well, I wonder if it has an SD card slot. Because gaming is just means it's a powerful, fast laptop. Oh, you know what's not great about the Shield is battery life. You're going to run it off battery to watch these movies?
Yeah.
The reason I like the Shield, and there are others like this, the Nexus 9, because it has front-facing left and right speakers. That makes it really good for watching movies. But I think battery life is not so hot on the Shield. How about a Samsung Galaxy tablet, maybe the Pro? Some of those have SD cards. You know what? If you've got the Do-Re-Mi for a Surface Pro 3, I think it's going to do exactly what you want. I think it's going to do more. That's all. It's going to be it's a Windows machine.
Yeah.
You're okay with that?
Is battery life okay on that?
Yeah, it's pretty good. I'm trying to remember. I think it's at least 5 hours. It might be a few hours more. If you want better battery life than that, you might want to look just at some of the notebooks out there, which, in fact, the new Dell 13-inch, for instance, which gets 15 hours of battery life. Or the MacBook Air 13-inch, which gets 12 hours of battery life. Tablets, most of the time, well, the iPad gets 10.
I like the idea of, like, the touch screen.
I agree, and a tablet's easier to use. It's just not a full computer. So this is the issue, really, that you have to solve in your mind. Your needs, if you're just surfing, watching movies, maybe doing some email, your needs are simple. Lightweight computing and a less expensive tablet would be more than enough. Get one with an SD card slot like the Galaxy Note. Or I'm sorry, the Samsung Note tablet. Because it's got an SD card slot, does everything you want. If you need Windows, well, then it becomes a little more complicated. There's some really nice Windows tablet convertibles like the Lenovo Yoga, which is great. The Surface Pro 3 is great, but they're going to cost you up north of $1,000. And you get a lot more complexity because you're getting a full version of a full-blown operating system. Chat room saying Galaxy Tab 8.4S has an SD card slot, great screen. Very usable. We're talking about $500. Don't get and much better battery life. So there's certainly choices out there. I wouldn't recommend a Surface unless you know you want Windows, I guess is the bottom line on that. Jeff in Santan Valley, Arizona.
Leo, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome, Jeff. Should it be called Suntan Valley?
Nope, it's San, S-A-N.
All right.
So I've got, I'm getting 100 meg down. I'm that guy where they say you'll get up to 50 meg, and I'm actually getting 102 from Comcast.
I hate you. you must be the only guy using it in your neighborhood.
I know for a fact that there's only one other person on the street because I talked to the guy when he was installing it at the box. So my internet connection is awesome. I've got gigabit Ethernet throughout the house.
Lovely.
Yep. And so I've got DirecTV that I've had for 2 years.
Yep.
And I originally had it wireless. It wasn't working out, so I plugged it into the wired network, and it was okay. However, it doesn't like to stream videos. When I start to play a movie on demand, it will say buffering, hey, your internet connection speed's not fast enough.
Well, isn't that frustrating? You got 100 megabits down, you got gigabit Ethernet, and it's buffering?
It's buffering. So I futzed with it for quite a while. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I run speedtest.net. I just ran it, 102 meg down, 16 meg up.
Yeah. So, and what is it? Is it Netflix that you're having buffering? Well, let me ask you this. Is it buffering for all streaming networks?
No. So I'm watching you on Bed Gravity at 1 meg down. My wife's in the bedroom on an LG smart TV watching Netflix. Works fine. My PS3 works fine.
Yeah, so, okay, good.
TV. has been the issue. And
it's
just this
hardware.
Yeah, so I got an Amazon Fire TV a couple of months ago, and it, I don't know, maybe 25% of the time does the same thing.
Hold on a second. We'll talk because we've got to take a break. Top of the hours here. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Yeah, it does look like that's weird. The guacamole requires, for some, it says it works with RDP, but for some reason it says it requires a Linux server. I don't understand how that works. How does that work?
I don't know.
Shoot, I thought we had a great solution. Guacamole. With a great name. Hey, Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, anything with a chip in it. Phone number 888-827-5536. That kind of works out to 8888-ASK-LEO. Easy to remember. 8888-ASK-LEO. I didn't mention our website yet. I should, because it's great. TechGuyLabs.com. You go there. Every show's there. Hour by hour, day by day, hour by hour, question by question. Audio and video from the show. Yes, we shoot video for a radio show. Crazy, I know, but we do it. So you can watch audio and video, be disillusioned by my actual appearance as opposed to the fantasy, Leo, that you have created in your mind. No, I'm not tall, dark, and handsome. You can also post your own comments there. So if you're listening and you have an opinion, you say, wait a minute, no, I use TeamViewer or whatever, put it up there. That's what that's there for. We appreciate it. You know, no sign up, no fee, no subscription. I don't want your email address. It's just a website, techguylabs.com. We were talking to Jeff in Santan Valley, Arizona. He's got a weird situation. Lots of internet, 100 megabits per second, well-wired with gigabit Ethernet throughout the house. He can watch, his wife can watch, but weirdly enough, on this one TV, even with a Fire TV, it doesn't work. He's getting a lot of buffering. And is it on all the different networks? Is Netflix plus Amazon plus everybody else, Jeff?
It is. On the Fire TV it is. And on the, like I said, the DirecTV is really the bigger problem. The Amazon Fire TV is normally pretty good. Sometimes it buffers or reduces the bandwidth on the video on Netflix.
It can, you know, I mean, it can be that the smart apps in a TV, I have this problem with my Panasonic Viera, they're terrible. It loses its connection all the time. It's sitting next to the router. It's connected via Ethernet. There's, you know, it's 100 megabit, like your 100 megabit. I have to pay for a business class connection, but I'm getting 100 megabits. And it's still, my TV often says, I don't know what's going on. But that smart TV, that's why I don't like smart TVs. They're generally not very well implemented. But if it's happening to your Fire TV, then that puzzles me.
It's the box. It's not the stick. It's not. Maybe I'm saying the wrong term. But
No. I'm sorry. I said stick. It's the Fire TV box. I got it.
Yeah.
Now let me ask you: the TV and the box connected hardwired, or are they connected via Wi-Fi?
No, it's just HDMI from the DirecTV and from the box.
Okay.
And I've reconfigured the network a couple of times. It's basically. I strung the wire myself, so I've, you know, I had different switches. I've actually changed internet companies in between. So it's one of those things where, and it's really the DirecTV. It doesn't seem like there's any way on either DirecTV or with the Amazon box to actually test your connection other than, hey, your Ethernet's connected.
Yeah, that's pretty typical. There's no speed test. Well, I need to understand this DirecTV thing. So you have a DirecTV satellite television. This is your satellite TV receiver, but you are also able to watch internet stuff.
No, I'm talking about streaming DirecTV content.
Got it. And what do you have? There's some box DirecTV gives you to connect to the TV?
Well, if you do DirecTV wired, there's a thing called a SWIM, SW. I think the I is in lowercase.
I got it. So you have a DirecTV receiver elsewhere in the house.
I do.
And then over the internet, it's connected to this SWIM box, which is connected to your TV.
Which then pumps it to the other smaller boxes that are in
the bedroom. It's not even going over the internet. It's going over your LAN.
yeah.
Your wired network.
Right. That's why it doesn't seem to...
Shouldn't ever buffer.
Could be.
You should never buffer. As long as your DirecTV, if you watch the DirecTV on the DirecTV box, and it's working fine. So it's something wrong. In fact, I would bet it's that little swim box is causing the problem. You know, it is possible for an Ethernet-connected device to bring down the whole darn network by spewing packets inappropriately. And I'm going to guess that there's something wrong, some sort of inappropriate packet spewing happening from this remote device. Now, I'm not familiar with these. I don't use DirecTV, so I'm not sure exactly how it works. It says it's a splitter, which seems odd. So I'm not sure what's going on here. But it's possible there's some sort of local interference created in that box there. So I would certainly first thing to do is check the cables, reconnect, maybe replace, because a bad cable can do this too. And then if that none of that fixes, then I would say, take a look at this SWM, this switcher. Maybe this is spewing some sort of noise into the network, and it's right there and making a mess out of it. Not sure, but that's what it sounds like. It's an odd situation, but the process of this of solving your tech problems is kind of this is actually a good example where you look at what's going on and then you consider what could cause it. You know, trying to think of all the things that could cause it, and then slowly eliminate those things. Eliminate the easy ones first, like replacing cables. We can eliminate a lot of things because the TV, his wife's watching Netflix, is fine. He's watching my stream, it's fine. So we know that his incoming internet is fine. So something localized, and it's interestingly enough, it's localized to this television set up right here. Now, the fact that it works with a Fire TV has problems as much as this DirecTV box has problems. Tells me that maybe it's something localized here. Could be the TV, could be the TV's connection. But it's something localized to this area. So that's where you start. You don't have to. I think you need not worry anymore about a speed test. I don't think that's the issue. Jack in Thornton, New Hampshire. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Jack.
Hey, Leo.
Hey, Jack.
All right. Well, I have so many questions, but I narrowed it down, and I have this one question. But have you heard about this Li-Fi? It's LIFI, and it uses light to transfer data between your ISP and your computer. It's pretty cool.
Very cool. This is not the first time we've seen these kinds of things. There are a number of internet service providers that use microwave as well. Microwave as well as Li-Fi require direct line of sight. In fact, you know, in the old days when you had a defense contractor and you wanted secure communication between buildings, you weren't going to use the public internet. They would use a similar system using lasers to send the data in a way that's not interceptable. It's line of sight, and you get a little bit off axis. You can't see anything. And I would guess that this Li-Fi is based on this. Are they actually offering this yet?
No, I emailed the guy, and he emailed me back. He was just asking me questions about how much you should charge and stuff. But he said it would be consumer available pretty soon, at least. So it was pretty cool.
You're a young person. You probably haven't had the experience I've had of being bitterly disappointed by new technologies time and time again throughout my entire career. I have become a cynic. So while in theory, this completely makes sense. In fact, if you think about it, what is fiber optic? It's exactly that. Using glass threads to channel light. That's what fiber optic is light. So in theory, this sounds good. There's issues. Like, okay, you're sending light, but is there fog? Is there rain? Does it work? No. So there are potential issues. I wouldn't run out and invest until he's really got up and running. Okay?
All right.
What else?
Well, I have...
In other words, I got to tell you, Jack, because you're young. I got to tell you, I hear every day 10 brilliant ideas that are going to change the way we live, work, and play. 9 out of 10 are bogus. 1 out of 10 could work but doesn't. It's very rare you get a new technology that really works. So be skeptical. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 ask. Leo is the number. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. Paul in Houston, Texas. Hi, Paul. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. You were talking about Be My Eyes at the top of the show.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think it's a great service. I love the idea. There's also another app called KNFB Reader where you point the iPhone at some printed text and it turns it into speech or Braille.
That's neat. So it reads it to you.
Yeah, and it's by Ray Kurzweil. It's supposed to be very fast and accurate.
Of course it would be great.
These services are great, but there's something that I don't think a lot of people think of, and that is accessibility versus privacy. The idea that what you're actually doing is you're taking a picture of something. Because you're blind, you don't know what it is, and that picture is being sent over the internet to a remote server. The NSA could be listening in at some point, like collecting that data and automatically parsing it with the automatic image recognition. And they learn, you know, not only the content of what's in the picture, but over time they're learning about the individual because they're learning what that individual has access to.
That's true.
The kind of information they get.
That's true.
So it's just this kind of
using the internet is inherently public. Even if you have assurances from Facebook or Instagram or even Snapchat that what you're doing will never be seen by anybody, unless you're very careful, it could very well be. If not by strangers, by the federal government, the NSA, there's always that risk. I mean, you're putting it on a public network. In fact, we've talked before, there really is only one way to ensure privacy besides not using the internet at all. And while you're at it, you probably shouldn't use credit cards. Or your phone, or, I mean, you pretty much have to go back to the dark ages. The other way to ensure privacy is something called end-to-end encryption. And
Yes. This
works well. This is something like PGP or GPG or, you know, many of the messaging apps have end-to-end encryption. What that means is only you and the recipient can read it. Even the NSA with their massive computers and databases can't read it. The problem with that is inconvenient because you have to prearrange to be using the encryption with the recipient. There's no reason why something like this EYES program couldn't do that, by the way. They probably haven't, but you might contact them and say, have you guys considered end-to-end encryption? Because that would protect your privacy when you're using it.
Yeah, and it's just a much more important issue, it seems to me, in the case of the blind, because it's just such a basic need for doing everyday tasks, and also because they don't know what they're looking at, what they're pointing that camera at until it's already sent to the server. Yeah.
Well, if you're deaf and you use a TTY operator, when you're blind or deaf or a number of disabilities, you often require assistance from another human being. And that puts you in that position, doesn't it? Anytime you rely on another human being, that other human being has access to stuff that maybe you don't want them to have access to. You know, if heaven forfend, I end up in the nursing home, I imagine another human being is going to have access to all sorts of things of mine that I wish they didn't. But, that's how it happens, I'm sorry to say. I think, you know, this is an important thing to remember. I agree. And by the way, thank you, Paul. It's a good thing. We talk about privacy a lot. And I think it's good to remember that there's two sides to that coin. That, and I often choose the public side because there are certain values that you get from being public. It is, of course, I'm sure, difficult and maybe even potentially humiliating to rely on another person for basic bodily needs or to go to the store. And yet, I'm sure you've experienced this, Paul. It can also be wonderful. It can be an amazing experience, sharing experience. And in general, while I understand our overarching concern of privacy, and certainly I would absolutely say that you have a right to be private. I don't know if it's actually in the Bill of Rights. In fact, I know it's not, but it ought to have been. It's interesting that our founders didn't think that that was a word that belonged in the Bill of Rights, isn't it? Some say it's implied by the Bill of Rights. I'm not sure that's true either. The right against unlawful search and seizure, for instance. And I think partly that's because you might say, well, they didn't know how intrusive the internet would become in the 18th century. Yeah, or maybe they understood that we are all dependent upon one another and that the notion of privacy itself is kind of odd. You know, in an era where they had a commons where everyone was to graze their cows and everybody kind of owned it, it may not have been something that came up. I don't know. I can't speak for the founders. But I do think that there are two sides to the coin of privacy and that sometimes being more public. I have a good friend, Jeff Jarvis, who suffered prostate cancer. Instead of, as many of us would, keeping it to himself, suffering privately or with his family, he decided to go very public on that. And there were some benefits. He got to talk to other sufferers. He learned things. Other people were encouraged and reassured. Perhaps one or two men thought, maybe I better get checked just in case. He may have saved lives by being public about it. So while, you know, your default might be, I'm going to keep everything private, you have to understand, first of all, the difficulty of doing that. And by the way, not just on the internet, in general, what we do, a lot of what we do is in public. And I think there are benefits that accrue to that. You don't want to, do you want to be a hermit and isolate yourself from the world entirely? That's private. But is that really what we want? So while I agree, we need to be, you know, certainly I would never say to anybody, you don't have the right to privacy. I do believe anybody has the right to assert their privacy. But also understand that you have to be reasonable about it. And you can't say, I want to be private and I want to use a credit card and walk around in public and use the internet, because they're maybe mutually inconsistent. You give up a certain amount of privacy when you use Facebook, period. You do. And everything you send out over the internet is potentially public. You should keep that in mind. And that doesn't, it's not defeatist, or I'm not giving up to say, well, it's just the way it is. It is just the way it is. And there are certainly things you can do. You don't have to use Google. You don't have to use Facebook. You don't have to use the internet. If privacy is paramount for you, then you shouldn't. But I would submit maybe there's some value to it. Maybe giving up some personal privacy isn't so horrible. Maybe it's not so bad. Something to just consider anyway, I guess. And if you're in the situation where you need assistance, whether it's to read the expired date on a gallon of milk or figure out what color something is, maybe it's not so bad asking somebody, hey, can you help me? I can't read this. What's the expiration date on this? Is this milk? What kind of milk am I looking at? Maybe it's not so bad. I don't know. I do know where it's a topic that we're very aware of now because of the internet. But I wouldn't say you should just default to everything's private. That's not necessarily the way to be. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. All right, now, briefly, let me mention how we get our phones to work here. It's kind of a miracle. It doesn't, in fact, involve... Oh, and speaking of privacy, encryption's built in. It doesn't involve using the phone company. It does involve using the internet. It doesn't involve having a PBX in the basement or needing a technician to service our phone system should something go wrong. It involves the cloud-based phone system that's the best in the world, RingCentral. RingCentral brings all your phone systems together in one place. Voice, fax, text, conference calling, and yes, even high-def video meetings. We love doing things in the cloud here at Twit. You know me, I'm a cloud fanatic. I just was talking about that. I think the benefits are fantastic. RingCentral is kind of a nice mix because everything you do is encrypted. All your calls are encrypted with secure voice. So, in fact, this is probably more private than using the public telephony system. RingCentral connects all your offices and workers together in a single system, even if they're all over the world. That's nice. Many offices are spread out. Sometimes people work from home. No one will know. With RingCentral, it's the same 800 number. You talk to them just like they're in the office. And yes, you can use your smartphone too. RingCentral integrates with iOS and Android devices. You can even make calls from your PC. And because it's cloud-based, it is so flexible, so customizable, and so affordable. You keep your current phone number, of course. You can even create vanity numbers, use toll-free numbers, local extensions, just like a phone system. But you get so many more additional features: shared lines, call parking, paging, advanced call forwarding, flexible answering rules, call log reports, and, of course, free 24/7 customer support. No setup fees. Nope. No activation fees neither. RingCentral, it starts at $25 per month per user. That includes everything. $25 per month per user, and you can start right now with a risk-free 30-day trial, plus a special offer just for our fans. If you're listening to the Tech Guy show, use the offer code TWIT, and you'll get a second phone for every phone you buy, free up to 20 phones. Visit ringcentral.com or call 800-543-9980. Use the promo code TWIT. RingCentral.com. Use the promo code TWIT or call 800-543-9980. We've been using RingCentral since we moved into the brick house, and it has been amazing. I couldn't go back. RingCentral.com. Don't forget the offer code is TWIT. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And let's go to Jim, Woodland Hills. Yeah, Jim in Woodland Hills, California. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I've got a question for you that it might be sort of an idiot test question as far as, are you dumb enough to try this? But what I have is an iPhone 4S, but it's one that my wife got from her sister-in-law. And so it no longer has a phone service, in other words. And right. We want to use it as a touch. Well, the problem is that I've been online, and apparently a lot of them have this problem. The Wi-Fi doesn't work. And what I've read is one method to fix that, and this is where the weird part comes in, is that a lot of people on YouTube say if you heat it up with a hairdryer until the temperature gauge comes on that says you've overheated it,
yeah,
and then you turn it off and stick it in the freezer for 10 minutes.
Do you have a dead chicken, an oven mitt, and a bundt pan?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it could. This actually doesn't sound as far-fetched as it is, but it's not a prescription I would follow. I think the reason that might work in some cases is if you've got, these are electronics devices that have solder holding them together, things like that. It might work to heat up the solder sufficiently to melt it a little bit and then quickly chill it so that it could fix a problem that's known as a cold solder.
Yeah.
That seems highly unlikely on something like the iPhone that is manufactured in such a precision way. But I guess it could work.
Well, is this a problem you've heard of, though? That, you know, I mean,
no.
Wi-Fi being totally dead on the things? Because we've even tried a total restore on it.
I know a lot of people who have used their 4Ss exactly as you plan to, as a phoneless touch.
Yeah.
That's a great idea. I have to say that I'm not sure why the Wi-Fi doesn't work. One thing you can do, if you have an independent iPhone repair shop in the area, and I bet you do, they're springing up like mushrooms. Mm-hmm. You can go in. These guys, and a 4S, it's very easy for them to take the entire thing apart and check the Wi-Fi chip, for instance. Check for bad solders, that kind of thing. That would be more reliable.
Yeah. Because then, I'm really wondering if this would just totally destroy the phone. You know,
It's not going to destroy it, but it's not. I don't think this is such a good idea. There's also, of course, if you go from hot to cold like that, the chance of condensing moisture inside the phone.
Hmm.
That's not good either.
Yeah.
So I don't think that I would recommend this as a solution. If it works, it's almost coincidental that it works. You know, it's conceivable to think about something that could be going on that could fix. It's not going to melt the solder, but cold solders, what a cold solder, and I don't even know if there's solders in the iPhone, frankly. I guess there must be. A cold solder is an improperly performed connection using solder where it doesn't actually have an electrical connection until it's warmed up.
Hmm.
It warms up and it starts working. But that doesn't really fit this fix. So I would say the other thing. Now somebody's saying, "Well, update the OS." It may be that. In fact, first thing I would do is restore the phone to its original factory state.
Yeah, we did that. Okay. In fact, we did it about 5 times.
Okay, good. Next thing is maybe install some operating system updates. You can, I think, go as far as iOS 8 on a 4S.
Hmm.
Now, somebody on the line, it works for Telenor, which is the biggest carrier in Norway. He says it's a very common problem with the 4 and the 4S. So, I doubt he recommends heating it with a hairdryer till it fails and then putting it in a freezer.
It would be interesting.
Yeah. It sounds like it's a cold solder. It could be that the heating expands some connection. That could be another thing that it's doing.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that would fix it, I don't know. I mean, I guess if the next choice is throwing it out,
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah.
What if it worked? Then you can make a video and put it on YouTube.
Really?
I think the way they make iPhones, and iPhone 4S is late enough model, they make these very precisely. And with great attention to detail. And it's much more likely that just something broke.
Yeah.
You know, it's a cold solder in a device like this seems highly unlikely. The guy who made your iPhone just made 4,000 other iPhones today. And, you know, he's pretty good at it by now.
Mm-hmm.
Try it if you're going to throw it out. Otherwise, I would say upgrade the OS. Maybe that'll fix it. Maybe it's a software issue. You did the first thing I'd do, which is restore the thing.
Well, I think the iOS, that would automatically be the most recent version once you do the restore.
No, that's not necessarily the case. It will restore to the latest version you've installed, but it won't automatically update it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Reballing. This is called reballing. I've never heard of this before. Wow. There's quite a bit about this. If an iPhone doesn't work anymore, you can reball it.
What the heck does that mean?
I don't know. I'm just going by what I see here on the internet. This is another case of a lot of YouTube videos around a subject that I've never heard of. So, but maybe this is related to. This thing of overheating it and then freezing. I think it's probably best to save that to just before you threw it off. Throw it out, I mean. Oh, somebody's asking, how are you going to do a restore if the Wi-Fi doesn't work and you have no cell service on the phone? You're going to do that from your computer via USB cable. That's an interesting question. I have not heard of this problem. Our Telenor friend says he has, but this is news to me, so I don't have an obvious fix. Mary in Lake Arrowhead, California. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Leo. I'm a first-time caller, long-time listener.
Okay.
And I think you've gone over this before. I have Windows still, XP on my computer, but I also have lots of downloads of programs and things where I don't have the CD backup. I need to reformat my hard drive because it's gotten bugs on it.
It's always good, Dad. It's always good to do that. You do have, it sounds like, the Windows install disks or the disks that came with the computer?
I have the Windows, the original restore, but it went back to...
Right. It's going to make it just like it came from the factory.
Actually, I can't find those discs, but I moved and everything's in box.
Well, this may be moot then. You're right. Once you do those, if you do find the disc, when you do a recovery, it erases everything, not just your data, but any apps right. You've installed since you exactly. got the computer. So,
okay, my question is usually you set up keys or it sets up keys or something on the computer, which is what it's looking for in order to run. And I'm just wondering if I've backed those things up and things, is there any way to restore the software that I've had from before? Or is there some place I can look to find the keys that I need
to
load them back in?
No.
No?
So the key is unique to you. Sometimes you can get it. For instance, your Windows key, you can usually get their programs that will find that on your registry. And you may be able to get some of those keys back. These are the serial numbers associated with your copy of the software. And software is often copy protected this way. If you can't enter the serial number, it won't activate.
Exactly.
If you didn't keep track of them in the first place and you don't have the install disks,
I'm SOL.
You're kind of SOL because you need the install disks at first. So a good tip is, yeah, when you first set up a computer, make a copy of everything, maybe an image copy, and keep those boxes around, or at least the keys. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We've been watching a video on YouTube during the break of a guy taking apart a laptop, melting the solder, removing parts, re-soldering it. Crazy stuff. Crazy stuff. And all this to preserve a Toshiba laptop that probably cost you $15 on eBay.
Wow.
But yes. People love it. It's fun. It's fun.
Yeah, I use the drop method.
What's that?
You drop it once, and if it doesn't work, give up. But you always have that possibility.
It might work.
Something might fall back in place.
People do all sorts of crazy things. I have heard people try to repair hard drives by sticking them in the freezer. And sometimes that does work. Once. Not twice. Once. Mm-hmm. Boy, you'd have to be pretty dedicated to do this. How much does an iPhone 4S cost? I think you could probably get an iPod Touch for a couple $100. Probably a better idea. Dick D. Bartolo, that's the other voice in the room. He is the Gizwiz, Mad Magazine's maddest writer. We love Dick. Every week he joins us with a gizmo or a gadget. Last time we talked, you just came back from CES, and you were a little under the weather. You feeling better now?
I'm feeling not 100%, but certainly getting better and using my frozen face these days because it makes me look better.
He never moves, but he sure does sound good.
I have the face for radio these days.
What do you got? Let me.
You know what? I found a neat gadget, and when the guy demonstrated it, I liked it even more. Okay, it's called it's another webcam, but it's called Pet Cube.
Pet Cube. Yes,
Pet Cube.
The webcam for Scotty dogs.
Oh, well, I think it's probably better for cats, but I'll tell you why. Because Pet Cube, not only can you lick in on your pet, talk to your pet, but there is a built-in laser.
Oh, so that you can play with your pet.
Yes.
Remotely.
And when the guy was demonstrating it, I said to him, so are those four cats yours? And he said, no, I have dialed into a shelter.
Wow.
And I'm playing with pets that are up for adoption.
Wow.
And he said, believe it or not, the people at the shelter said since they put this in, three cats have been adopted by people who had so much fun playing with them over the Wi-Fi and the internet. They came down to see them in person and ended up adopting these pets. So the other great thing is you can just give out your web address for your cat.
You can have
your
other
cat.
People play with your cat.
Exactly. You know, you could come home and Ozzy could be by the door saying, please shut it off.
I keep playing with me. There's a laser. So it looks like a little clock radio almost. You control it with your smartphone.
Exactly. It's a cube. It's a 4x4x4-inch cube, Android and iOS. And then
you can see your pet via camera, but you can talk to your pet too.
You can talk to your pet. You can also shoot videos of your pet as they're playing and put those right on the internet.
Oh, Lord.
I know.
just when you need another source for cat videos.
Cat and dog videos. You know, does Ozzy respond? Charlie will play chase a red laser dot.
He'll chase a laser dot?
Yeah, Charlie will. But yeah. Fairway,
he's too
kidding?
Smart, I think.
Too
yeah.
smart.
Yeah, that doesn't fool
How about,
me.
Will Ozzy chase a
I've
laser
I've never
dot?
Tried.
Oh, okay.
But maybe, you know, I think it requires a certain, I don't know, stupidity?
Oh,
is that the word I'm looking for?
No, gamesmanship.
That's the word.
Right.
No, cats do that. Cats will absolutely do that. I've seen them do it. It's amazing. But my dog, I think Ozzy would just look at it and go, I really don't know why that thing is running around, but I'm just going to stay here.
Oh, okay.
I'm resting now. How much is the Pet Cube?
$199.
Is it available now?
It is available. It started shipping the first week of December, and we're in January, so it is online at petcube.com.
Oh, I'm so tempted to get this. But we don't, you know what? We don't leave our dog at home very often. We take him, I take him, because this is one advantage of having your own studio. I can take him here. And he's just,
that's true. You can
torment him here in person instead of remotely via my $200 pet cube. But if
I also thought you could use it as a security thing. If you see somebody breaking in, you put the laser dot on their head and just say, I have you in my sight.
I could see you. Do not poop on the floor.
That would work. Actually, this probably does. You probably put the pet cube on the floor, right? You don't put it up on the counter.
No, you put it down very low.
So if somebody does break in, you'll at least know what kind of shoes they wore.
That's true.
Always useful. Sometimes even enough to get the police involved. He was wearing brogues, Irish brogues. Dick DiBartolo is the GizWiz. We call him that because he's got a website called GizWiz.biz. And that's where you can go to see all the stuff he talks about. Full links to all the gadgets he mentions, not only on our radio show, but also on the TV shows he does, like the World News Now on ABC. He also has a What the Heck Is It game, which is a lot of fun, a close-up of a gadget or a gizmo from his warehouse, and gives away autographed copies of Mad Magazine for people who can correctly identify it or make him laugh with their ridiculous suggestions. Either way.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Yeah.
This one is
actually right now. I'll give you this used to be the iPhone 6 repair tool.
It's a reballing device.
It is.
Yeah. What was last week's looked like? Last month's looked like a coin sorter, but it wasn't. It was a battery holder.
Yeah, that was Storacell.
Yeah.
Neat. To store your Duracells or any battery, actually.
Thank you, Ricardo.
Yes, sir.
All right. We'll talk to you later. Dick DiBartolo, Mad Magazine's maddest writer. I got a couple more minutes. Maybe I can get a couple more calls in here. Let's go. Is this possible to Reykjavik? Hey, how are you, Beanie?
Pretty good. And you, sir?
I am well. What is the weather like right now in Iceland?
It's just 5 to 10 at the evening, and it's 6 degrees Celsius.
Perfect. If I had an iPhone, I'd put it in the oven and throw it outside. I would fix it like that. Well, it's so nice to talk to you. I've always wanted to go to Iceland my whole life. All the photographers I know go there because it's so beautiful, both in winter and summer.
It is. Yeah. Fantastic place to
live. Well, what can I do for you, Beanie?
I'm wondering about Macintosh. I watch your show on Twitch, MacBook Weekly every week, and big fan.
Thank you so much.
I was wondering if the performance, say for instance on Photoshop, is it similar on or similar or better on Mac Mini, which cost about $1,000 with i5 2.8 gig CPU.
Yep.
Like HP, we can get an HP desktop mini kind, small device with i7 for $1,000.
Yeah. There's two things that, actually three, that determine the speed of Photoshop. Photoshop, for much of what it does, is what we call CPU bound, the i5 or the i7. The speed of that chip is what matters, and not just the pure gigahertz, but also how many cores are on that chip, because Photoshop does understand multiple cores. As often is the case with multi-core, it's only going to make a difference when you're doing something that can be easily divided up among the four processors. So, for instance, opening a menu, opening a file, those kinds of things do not get sped up. Those are dependent, opening a file, for instance, on the speed of the drive. So a solid-state drive, for instance, is going to be much faster for opening and saving files. And then the final thing that makes a difference, the third part of this equation, is the graphics unit. Some of Photoshop, not all, but some of Photoshop's processes are GPU-bound. They're dependent on the graphics processor unit. The most famous is the Gaussian blur, where you take a photograph and you want to create a blur Photoshop is smart enough to be able to divide that into multiple threads and to use a graphics processor to do the processing. So in that case, it would depend a lot on what GPU the HP had versus the Mac Mini. The Mac Mini is using Intel's Iris graphics processor, and not the Iris Pro probably on that i5, but just the standard Iris. It's okay. It's not super fast. But again, how often do you do a Gaussian blur? And are you willing the one time you do that to go get a cup of coffee? Probably. So I think that while there are speed differences, it's dependent on different factors, and it depends on what you're doing. And I probably don't think you're going to notice much of a difference, even between an i7 and an i5. The biggest difference in i7 and i5 is that the i7 is hyper-threaded, so it can give you double on a four-core i7, for instance, can give you 8 different threads, 2 per core. But I think in a lot of cases, you're not going to notice the difference very much.
Okay. But in general, the Mac OS is...
OS and all of that stuff, it's the same, yeah. Mm-hmm. I've heard people often say that Photoshop is fastest on a Windows machine. Hey, we're out of time. Thank you for the call from Iceland. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. I'm Leo Laporte. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, the Tech Guy is just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows now on the Twit Netcast Network, and you'll find them all at twit.tv. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on MacBreak Weekly, iPad on iPad Today. You get your daily dose of tech news from Tech News Today and our weekly roundtable show, This Week in Tech. It's all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next time with another great Tech Guy podcast. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.